And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. People still talk about it at the Christmas basketball tournament over at Reynolds Coliseum at State. It's the Dixie Classic. It's been gone for so many years. But we still remember, and whenever you get a group of people talking about basketball in the old times, a Dixie Classic story will come up. But we haven't had the full story until now. And Bethany Bratcher is the author of a new book. It's called The Classic: How Everett Case and His Tournament Brought Big Time Basketball to the South. And we've lassoed her, and she's ready to tell us the stories in the books and help us remember those. Wonderful Dixie Classic days. Bethany Bratcher, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, it's great to be here, D.G. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is what the one thing that startles me is there's an age divide among us. Those people who really experienced it, the Classic, who are old enough to have gone or to have had a friend who went or read about it in the paper contemporaneously. We're kind of passing on. But I thought that the book would be written by one of us rather than by one of you and your generation. And how did you get into this book?
Well, for starters, I am a sports writer and a journalist, and I've always loved historical books, historical nonfiction. My favorite types of books are books that take an event in history and something that, you know, people have forgotten, or some people have, or maybe have forgotten the details of, and they dust it off and retell it to a new generation and to those who, like I say, their memory may be faulty at some point. And so I love those types of books. I read them every chance I get. A good example is the book about Seabiscuit, which I devoured, and I don't even care about horse racing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, she made that era come to life, and she's a great writer. And so I've kind of been looking out for something like that. My first book came out in March 2010. It was the story of Keith LeClair, who was the baseball coach at East Carolina, who died of Lou Gehrig's
disease. Right.
And that was a modern-day book, a very different, more of a biography, and was looking for something a little different. And in the course of that, was talking to an NC State fan friend of mine who mentioned the Dixie Classic, and I did some research, and I knew almost nothing about it. I had gone to Carolina in the late 80s, early 90s, and was a big ACC basketball fan and a sports writer, but this was something
history had slipped
away a little bit. And so that made it perfect, because if I, as a fan and a sports writer, didn't know much, I thought there's a whole generation out there that needs to know this story. And the more I got into the research, the more I realized it was, you know, what a big tournament it was and the impact it had on the sport in this region.
Yeah, but still, that's a big assignment. Or did you feel handicapped or liberated by not having personal memories of the Classic?
Maybe a little bit liberated. I guess it was, you know, if I'm trying to tell the story to people like me, then I can go at it, you know, understanding where they're coming from and kind of learning along with them. And so that part didn't bother me. It helped that I had some wonderful assistants along the way, chief among those Lou Pasillo, who was an All-American for NC State. Some other friends, George Whitfield, who many listeners will know. He's a legendary high school baseball coach from Eastern North Carolina who knows everybody. And people like that who I already got to be friends with, and they gave me contacts, and they trusted me and kind of gave me entree with all these people that were important to the telling of the story. But I think as a journalist, to be a little bit impartial was helpful, and to try to tell the story in a very complete way.
Well, I don't want to persuade anybody not to buy your book, I think, but I think if you'll tell us a little bit of the story, and you don't have to tell it the way you told it in the book, but now you're going out on book tour and you're giving talks, what excites you most, and what do you find excites people that you talk to what is the Dixie Classic story?
Well, the story, to me, is best encapsulated, if I have to get a one picture of little boys running downstairs Christmas morning to get those tickets. I hear it over and over. It's almost a cliche, but it's a real cliche. that I said maybe hundreds of people have told me that, and I don't think I'm using hyperbole
Santa,
here.
Santa Claus had a printing press to print Dixie Classic tickets.
He had a straight, access line, although Harry Stewart, who I interviewed also, was the one responsible for giving tickets away.
I tell you what, I'm so excited about this because I know what you're talking about, but I realized that there are a lot of people from your generation. Tell us, hold that question for a minute.
Sure.
And tell us what was the Dixie Classic, or what was the Dixie Classic?
It was a holiday basketball tournament held every year at Reynolds Coliseum between Christmas and New Year's. And it started in 1949, just weeks after Reynolds Coliseum opened. They were still putting seats in, when they were preparing for the first Dixie Classic. And the last tournament was played in 1960. So there were 12 in all. It always featured North Carolina State, UNC, Wake Forest, and Duke, and four visiting teams. And it was the brainchild of Everett Case, who was a legendary head coach at NC State, who was an Indiana native, came from a basketball hotbed and was widely credited with bringing kind of the passion and the excitement for the sport to North Carolina. People of my generation can't imagine a time when that wasn't the case, when passions for college basketball did not run high. But in fact, when Everett Case came in the mid-40s, it was really more of a football state in terms of the way people regarded their college athletics. And he came in and said, I want to see a basketball goal in every driveway in the state. And part of his effort, he was a promoter and an innovator, and he said, I want to have a big tournament. He had this wonderful arena, which he had expanded and helped to dream what that arena would be like. And once it was completed, he said, I want to do something special. And along with some friends, came up with this plan. So the tournament, really, as it went on through the years, became the destination of choice for, any college basketball coach. To be invited meant that your team was contending nationally and was a power. And so it just developed an amazing reputation along the way.
Was this an enterprise of Everett Case and North Carolina State University, or did the Wake Forest and Carolina and Duke institutions, were they partners, or were they just part of the paid crew to come and play?
They were regular guests, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. They always knew they were going to be invited, but it was Everett's show. He picked the officials. In fact, later when the tournament was canceled, and we can talk more about that mm-hmm. later on, but there were those from the other schools who said, this just wasn't fair. This was Frank McGuire from North Carolina being tired of the NC State bias and the whole thing. So it was an NC State-run tournament. Willis Casey, who was the athletic director there for many years, was kind of the detail man. Everett was kind of the dreamer of the whole thing. And so he brought in these teams, and he made the decisions and was the big host to the visitors that came in. And having said that, North Carolina State had the most success at the Dixie Classic. But every one of the Big Four teams did win at least one trophy, one championship, and no outside team ever won.
No.
So that's one of those facts that people love, at least those of us around here. No outside team ever won the championship in 12 years.
Now that is really, but now state dominated, I guess. State was the dominating?
They did early. They won the first four going away. There were those who said it was just boring there for a while. C.A. Dillon, in fact, said, those early years, it was kind of boring basketball because state just had a corner on that market. But over, as the years went on, and this is part of why I feel like in the Dixie Classic are the seeds of what we now enjoy, all these rivalries and the dominance that basketball in this area has enjoyed. Over the years, when Everett Case had so much success, the other schools started to try to replicate that. So they brought in coaches who, kind of knew how to recruit and had new methods and new techniques that could mirror Everett Case's. And they just grew in dominance. Wake Forest started to challenge state first, and then Carolina. And, in the book, as you go through these years of the tournament, you can see each of those rivalries kind of develop. And in 1953, the fifth year of the tournament, Duke actually won. It was their one title. And so that was state's first year to have to give it up. And then state won the next two. So they really, those early years, like we said, they were very dominant. But then Carolina in 56, which was the year of their undefeated national championship season, because this tournament happened before New Year's. So the 56 Dixie Classic was Carolina's first title, and then they went on to run the table and win the national championship, which most people know that story. and then they won again. Carolina ended up winning 3, Wake Forest won 1. So it is neat. I couldn't have scripted it better, that at least every Big Four fan gets their own little moment in the sun. But NC State had a few more moments than the rest of them.
Well, we're visiting with Bethany Bratcher about her new book. It's called The Classic, and the subtitle is How Everett Case and His Tournament Brought Big-Time Basketball to the South. She and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Bethany Bratcher. She is a sports writer, a mom, and the author of a wonderful new book called The Classic. It's about the Dixie Classic. And Bethany, thanks for bringing back memories. Let me just ask you about the first Dixie Classic. You and I were talking about how it got to be so popular that kids all over North Carolina hoped that they would get a couple of tickets from Santa Claus or from their mom and dads at Christmas so they could go to the Dixie Classic. Was it an instant success? Was it sellout from the beginning? What was that first Dixie Classic like?
It took a little bit of time to catch on. Now, it was never a bust. I mean, there was interest from the get-go. People were certainly excited about Reynolds Coliseum. So in that first year, like I say, it was the same month that Reynolds had opened, and people may have just wanted to get inside there and to see what this was all about. It was a novelty. Was not a sellout the first year. In fact, there's an anecdote that there was a Raleigh businessman who bought 500 tickets just to kind of give him a boost. But that was the only time something like that had to happen. And as the years went on, attendance, you know, records were broken every year, with the top attendance year being 1960, which was the final tournament. And usually every session was sold out except to the consolation round on the final day, where the seventh and eighth place teams.
The last, playing for last place.
Yeah. Exactly. That was the only one. And it was close. I mean, it was a couple hundred seats that were usually available for that session. But in every other case, you couldn't get a seat in that place.
Can you remember how much the tickets cost back then?
Oh, gosh.
It seems like a dollar or $2.
A dollar or two a piece, and you could get a book for the whole tournament for about $12. And that was, you know, 4 games a day for 3 days.
Well, at the $50 and $60 single game tickets of today.
Yes.
Make you kind of long for that.
Well,
that's
it really does.
A different era. And what did I want you to talk a little. You've made Everett Case the hero of this a book, at least of the organization of it, and you've even put his name in the title as the central character. What kind of person was he? Was he the same sort of Bones McKinney, Frank McGuire, Lefty Driesell type coach who commanded a lot of attention and said, you know, spoke out and was a media guy?
He was. Now, nobody was as colorful as Bones McKinney. I mean, I believe that he takes first place in our state, you know, sports history in terms of colorful characters.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So he wasn't quite the, you know, the character in that regard. But Everett was definitely not afraid to speak his mind, had an ongoing feud with Frank McGuire, which some say was a little more theater than anything else, maybe designed to pump up that rivalry.
But talk about that. What was the feud about, and why do you think it might not have been real?
Well, there were some who played for those two who said that there was a story that they used to have breakfast together on Sunday mornings. But in public, they refused to shake hands on more than one occasion. They criticized each other in the press. At one point, Everett Case said, you know, you tell Frank McGuire I'll run my team any way I wish. And, you know, he can't tell me how to coach my ball club. And, you know, it was good theater. And no one's really sure, but I do think there was a respect there. You know, and we certainly can see some coaching rivalries in more recent eras in our state that are probably a little bit similar, where, you know, it's pretty good for the camera, or in that case, not the television camera, but for the press, to continue that that rivalry.
Well, now, this is interesting to me because you're ambiguous in your answer about this. You said maybe they had breakfast together on Sunday mornings, and maybe this was more for show. But other people would say maybe they really did. Well, we know Frank McGuire was a feisty, you know, feisty guy, and he got in arguments and had, I mean, he I loved him. But But he was ready to get in a fight with anybody on his side or on the other side. So
that's certainly true.
I don't mean to press you too much, but do you, after all this investigation, do you really believe that they just made up this rivalry?
I don't think they made it up. I think there were definitely times that they were angry with each other and didn't agree with each other's perspective. You know, Everett was a Midwesterner. Frank McGuire was an Irishman from Hell's Kitchen. You know, they had very different backgrounds, but both were committed to the sport and I think to the growth of the sport. And I don't think when it came right down to it that they just were mortal enemies. I think there was a respect there, if not a fondness.
All right, but just one more time, do you think they really had breakfast together on Sunday mornings?
I never had an eyewitness for that. Lenny Rosenbluth was the one who said he'd heard that. So let's give that to Lenny and you know, we'll chase it down. I saw them at the breakfast table. I'd like to think it. How about that? Since they're two of my top five, I wish I could have interviewed. I wish I could have asked them that question.
Yeah, that would have been great. Well, now, along the lines, we'd like to talk about the North Carolina teams, but some of really fine teams came to the Dixie Classic and brought stories. I mean, and left stories with them, but didn't take any championships away. What are some of the stories of some of the some of the good teams who came?
Well, Minnesota actually gets kind of top billing for me when I think about that question. Minnesota was the only outside team to come more than twice. There were several who came twice, but Minnesota actually played in the Classic three times. And their kind of shining moment was when they almost toppled NC State for the championship. You know, I already said that no outside team ever won, but in 1954, State beat Minnesota by 1 point, 85-84, in the final game. So not only were they the only one to come more than twice, they came the closest. That was the closest final game in the Dixie Classic history, and Minnesota was the consolation winner. So they definitely inspired quite a few memories on the part of those who attended. Now, beyond that, you have to mention Cincinnati and Michigan State in 1958. That was the tournament that, when I talked to people early on and I'd say, hey, I'm writing a book about the Dixie Classic, the first thing out of everyone's mouth was, 1958, Oscar Robertson.
Oh, and was Oscar Robertson the first African-American player to come to the...
He was not, and that was something I had to dig and find. Well, there was actually a player who came in 1957 named Seth Hicks. He was a player for Seton Hall, and unfortunately, he has passed away. I wasn't able to talk to him, but he only played in one game, and then he got injured. So in the box score, he has 2 points in the 1957 Dixie Classic. So that's probably why most people didn't remember that, but he did come in 58, however, because of Oscar Robertson being the number one player in the country and Cincinnati the top-ranked team. You know, this was an entirely different level of attention. And Johnny Green, who was a star for Michigan State, was also one of the top players in the country. I mean, he was just unbelievably athletic, and people loved to watch him. And I got to interview him, and they both had long NBA careers. Everybody knows about Oscars, but Johnny Green also did. And so when they came in 58, that's when kind of a lot of things crystallized, and some of the best basketball that, by all accounts, has ever been played in Reynolds Coliseum, it was really transpired during that time.
Well, Bethany, I'm interested in that period. You know, we think of the 60s as the time when black basketball players really broke into the Atlantic Coast Conference and to basketball at the formerly all-white schools in North Carolina. But what was it? And we think of the 50s as being still, you know, just a year or two after Brown versus Board of Education, and the South hadn't really embraced desegregation in any respect. Were the stands at the Dixie Classic segregated, and how did the fans react to watching black basketball players play on their turf?
Well, the first question about the stands, the fan base was white at the Dixie Classic.
Right.
By all accounts, everything I have ever heard, and that was a pretty all-white realm. You know, in those days, there was some great innovation happening. Like, there was a coach at North Carolina Central named John McClendon.
Yeah.
Who they say that, you know, Everett Case is widely credited with bringing the fast break offense down to North Carolina, but when you go a little deeper, it was actually John McClendon. And they say that he was actually a student of James Naismith himself. So there's a great story there, but some of that basketball, some of the innovations that were happening at African-American universities were, you know, largely unknown at that time. They kind of had their own basketball culture. And the big schools had a more of a white, an all-white basketball culture in North Carolina. So so when African-American players did finally start coming, and it took a while. In fact, I have a story in the book about they invited Oregon to come play. North Carolina State invited Oregon to come play in the Dixie Classic in 1950, but they asked them to leave their African-American players.
Oh, they did. So in 1950, still had to say, leave your black players at home.
And they asked him to come, and the Oregon athletic director declined because he did not think that that was right. And so, you know, early on, there was this kind of attitude that, you know, we're not even going to bring opponents. And, you know, the Pacific Northwest and the Northeast, they integrated their teams long before the South. And so it was something that was coming up more and more for Everett Case and Willis Casey as they organized the tournament. So Everett invited Cincinnati actually a couple of years before they came, when Oscar Robertson he was a pretty great player from the very beginning. So he looked and thought, I'm putting thoughts in his head, but I know he was a kind of promoter that would probably say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do it right, and we're going to bring in somebody that, you know, that is so talented that it's going to make people take notice. And he'd certainly brought in players that you couldn't miss because of their ability on the court. Now, one of the things that I learned as I went through this is that, and it doesn't surprise me, is that those teams could not stay in the hotel there in Raleigh, the Sir Walter Raleigh Hotel, because it was still segregated. So they had to find alternate accommodations for the Cincinnati and Michigan State teams in 1958. And I go into that in some detail.
Where could you find it? In 1958, North Carolina, where could you find a hotel that would, a good hotel that would take a mixed basketball team?
They did not find a hotel. They were actually in a fraternity house that at one time, it was on Tryon Road in Raleigh, and at one time it had been the Colonial Pines Hotel. That hotel had closed and the fraternity had bought it, and I was able to talk to a fraternity member named Bob Kennel who was part of getting that house ready for those two teams to come play. So they kind of, as best they could, you know, shoved their stuff under the beds or in closets and try to turn it back into a hotel. And two, in Cincinnati and Michigan State's credit, the entire team stayed there. I mean, it wasn't just the African-American players. And there were actually two players on each roster who were African-American. I mean, the two I mentioned, Oscar Robertson and Johnny Green, were better known. But they each had a teammate as well who was black. And so those fraternity members stayed around over the break and helped, you know, serve meals and kind of keep things clean. I mean, they tried to help be as hospitable as they possibly could in, you know, what was not an ideal situation.
Well, now, you mentioned that the fan base for the Dixie Classic was almost entirely black, almost entirely white.
Mm-hmm.
But when you had these star African-American players coming in from outside to play, surely the black population of the area, I mean, some of the sports fans wanted to come see these people. Were they able to come and watch, or did they come and watch?
Not that I have ever found. And I think that, you know, no one has told me any anecdotes of that sort. And when I've asked, and pictures I've seen of the crowd and all that, it was an all-white affair. And, you know, if it had gone on longer, there's quite a few things like that we can say if the Dixie Classic had gone on longer, because it was just a couple of years after those big-time players came and kind of broke the color barrier in style, that the tournament was canceled. So you'd like to think that the crowd would have been more integrated as time went on.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the Dixie Classic, and we're talking with Bethany Bratcher. He's the author of the new book about the Dixie Classic. It's called The Classic, How Everett Case and His Tournament Brought Big-Time Basketball to the South. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the Dixie Classic. A lot of people my age and a little bit younger remember it with fondness. It's our introduction to big-time basketball. And now Bethany Bratcher has written a book about it, chronicling the beginnings to the end, and she's agreed to talk to us a little bit about this book, Bethany. We talked a lot about the origins, and we talked a little bit about the impact or the contribution that the Dixie Classic made to the desegregation of North Carolina basketball by bringing black players to the Classic in 1957 and 1958. What were the highlights of the last 2 years or the last few years of the Classic? And you had, I'm suggesting this because I have answers in my mind. I'm thinking about Bones McKinney. I'm thinking about Frank McGuire. I'm thinking, I guess, a little bit about the post-North Carolina basketball after the national championship. And what was it? Was it different in those last years than it was at the beginning?
Well, I would say, you know, in my mind, 59 was a highlight for Wake Forest fans. You know, 59 was Wake Forest's one Dixie Classic championship. So we're talking, you know, that year after, in 1958, which we talked a little bit about last segment with Oscar Robertson and Johnny Green and such intense basketball. And Wake Forest was not really among the teams that were highly touted that year. And NC State actually won that 1958 tournament, which I would say was probably their biggest Dixie Classic victory because they weren't expected to, not with those, you know, heavy hitters in the field. So they took that championship, and it was their final championship. In 59, Wake Forest came in kind of out of nowhere, really on the back of a 5'10 guard named Billy Packer, who a few of you may have heard of. And he ended up being the MVP of the 1959 tournament when the Demon Deacons won their one, you know, championship. And I got to go interview Billy and about his memories, and it was so interesting. He had some great stories. But the story from that year that sticks with me the most is that Murray Greeson, who'd been the coach of Wake Forest for 30 years, he had just recently retired and given the reins to Bones McKinney. And he was there because he was still part of the athletic department, and he was watching, and they won. You know, they won the championship, and he ran down on the court, and his son, Murray Greeson Jr., told me that he looked out and he saw his father dancing a jig with Bones McKinney at midcourt, and it was just indelible for him to see that. And so Murray Greeson Jr. went down to the locker room to try to celebrate. He was in law school at the time, but he had been a student manager and been part of the program, and the guard wouldn't let him in.
Oh, really?
Who he was. And that night, Murray Greeson went on a hunting trip in eastern North Carolina, and the next morning on the way home, he was killed in a one-car accident in Greensboro.
Wow.
So the last time, you know, his son and everybody saw Murray Greeson alive was at midcourt at the Dixie Classic celebrating with Bones McKinney.
Well, and no, I didn't. Yeah, that's got to be a great story.
Very compelling, yeah. And it was very, you know, generous of Murray Greeson Jr. to share it with me because I know it was difficult, but you know, I don't know if I've ever heard of a program that had a higher high and a lower low in that very short amount of time, as Wake Forest did in 1959.
Well, those are memories that are that come back strong to me. I remember Packer and Lynn Chapel and Bones McKinney. And I wondered, I'd forgotten about the coaching transition that took place at that moment. Was who recruited those two important players? The Packer and the Chapel came from out of North Carolina. Who went up and got him and brought him down? Was that Bones or was that Murray?
It was Bones, and it's a little bit fuzzy there. I think Murray was still the head coach during the time when those two officially came in the door as freshmen, but Bones had taken many of those responsibilities. You know, he had taken more and more on. The story behind that I love is that Bones was at Duke one time playing a game. I don't even remember exactly what the context is. I just heard this, so it's not in the book, but it was so great. And he said, Hal Bradley, I think at the time, was the coach at Duke. And he said, can I make a phone call in your office? And he goes, sure, Bones, you know, take all the time you need. And he went in there and he closed the door. And on the back of the Duke coach's door were names and addresses and phone numbers of all these players.
Oh, no.
And he grabbed a notepad and jotted them down. And one of them was Lynn Chapel and another was Billy Packer.
No, that's just too good a story. I didn't know that story.
So. I know. That's what I love is I've been out promoting the book. I've heard things that I wish were in the book, you know, and Bones McKinney, I think, could fill several volumes. Just his stories alone.
Well, that's interesting. Has there been a Bones McKinney book? I mean, there was,
you know, he wrote one himself called Honk If You Love Basketball with Garland Atkins. It was, you know, really very much anecdotal. I mean, full of his stories, but I think there's more to be told.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for you to do that now.
Thank you. I'll get right on it. Right when we get off the phone.
That's a great story. Now, the other, I mean, we're getting off topic a little bit, but Billy Packer, as you mentioned, is a name that a lot of us know because until just a year or two ago, Billy Packer was on this station and on stations across the state sharing his wisdom with us, and he was on television and I thought one of the savviest commentators about basketball. You tracked him down, but what did you learn? What's happened to him? Why has he gone out of business?
He's just enjoying his retirement. I mean, you know, some retired players and or broadcasters really still kind of live in the basketball glory, and from my time with Billy Packer, I think he's reading books about World War II and doing different things, you know, traveling and spending time with family. And he's not a guy to keep clippings or anything like that. I mean, he very much was generous and with his time to share with me. But you can tell that he's kind of just trying to enjoy his retirement and go a different route, because you don't hear much from him.
Now, is he living in
Charlotte?
In Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Not in Winston-Salem. And,
yeah.
Well, now, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about what happened. What happened to the Dixie Classic? We're talking about the Dixie Classic with the author of a new book on that topic. Bethany Bradshaw's book is called The Classic, and she and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking with Bethany Bradshaw about her new book, The Classic, which is about the Dixie Classic. And Bethany, lots of great stories. And we've hardly touched the surface of some of those that you told in the book. And, you know, the story of the Dixie Classic is, I guess it's like a tragedy, because it starts out with all this happiness and then it ends in dishonor and disgrace, mm-hmm. and great anguish. And the story, we tell it today, our friend and the guy we admire so much, William Friday, is still here to, and Chancellor Aycock is still here to quietly and carefully and convincingly explain why they had to eliminate it. But there's still people who are hollering about it, aren't there?
Oh, yes. Yes. And that one of the things that made me think this was a good book topic was the passion with which people argued about, you know, the fact that the Dixie Classic never should have been canceled, and the conspiracy theorist afoot, which exists in every, you know, anytime something good ends, there's a conspiracy theorist out there.
Well, tell us what happened, and then mm-hmm. tell us the theories about what was going on behind the scenes.
I will do that. Well, what happened was there was a point shaving scandal that really was kind of starting to spread all over the nation in the late 50s. And there was a network of gamblers, mostly out of New York, but some in Chicago, who were paying basketball players to throw or fix games. And they would recruit often up in the Catskills, where the basketball players would work and play ball in the summers. And, you know, like I said, it was a nationwide scandal. And I spend quite a bit of time in my book with trying to follow the path of Jack Malinas, who was known as the mastermind. And his story in itself is fascinating. It's Hollywood. But tragic, because I don't believe he ever knew right from wrong. I mean, he really did this kind of thing his whole life and had been a superstar, or could have been. He played at Columbia and also in the NBA for one season. But anyway, Jack Malinas was part of this, and somebody who was under him, named Joe Green, had recruited some NC State and some Carolina players.
What did they recruit him to do? What was the deal?
Well, they were asking them to, you know, the way it was sold to them was, you don't need to throw the game, you don't need to lose it, you just need to make sure that the points come in under the spread. You know, the point spread, it made it easy for a gambler to convince a player, you know, it's okay, you know, we don't really want you to lose it. We just want you to make sure that you don't win by a certain number of points.
So how would the player do that? What was the deal?
Well, they thought that they normally needed two on the floor at a time for it to really be effective. That was kind of the prevailing wisdom. But there was a lot of bad defense. There were shanked free throws. There, you know, in the case of our story, there were some NC State players who, you know, were in the pockets of these gamblers, and they were making $1,000 a game in the late 1950s.
Well,
I mean, that is some serious money for a college student. And they would target college kids often who came from very poor backgrounds. Some of them had a wife and a baby already. And, you know, they knew who they were looking for. And in this case, there was a game in late 1959 that was a regular season game against Georgia Tech. And some of the top defensive players on the Wolfpack squad were just not playing defense at all. And they weren't executing plays that they had done perfectly in practice. And Everett Case, it got so bad that he was suspicious of his own team. And what really got the ball rolling on the investigation that eventually brought down the Dixie Classic was Everett Case went to Lester Chalmers, who was the district solicitor in Wake County, and said, I want you to investigate and see if my players are involved with this.
And what happened?
Well, they found that they were, that there were four NC State players.
How did he find it out?
he just hit the pavement. I mean, I grew to really admire Lester Chalmers. He has passed on, but I got to interview his widow, Alta. He and Bill Friday, one of the little sub-themes for me was the kind of the greatest generation. You know, they had both served in the war. And were both young. You know, Lester Chalmers was in his late 30s, and Bill Friday was 40 when all this went down. And they were very courageous, and they worked very, very hard. Now, there are some that obviously disagreed with Bill Friday's decision, but I really believed in his integrity in trying to do what was right. And as the investigation went on and those two men started to communicate, they found that some of these players had been physically threatened by the gamblers when things didn't go right, when the point spread, you know, was exceeded, and they would, you know, have to give their money back. But in a couple of cases, they had to take walks in dark alleys, and the player thought there was a gun involved. You know, they were threatened. And so Bill Friday would say, this is the reason that we had to de-emphasize basketball and cancel the Dixie Classic, because things have gotten way too far.
How did the decision come about, and how was it announced, and what was the reaction of the fans?
Well, it was very hush-hush, you know, there for a little bit. It was around March when the newspaper headlines started to come through that there were local players involved. And then it was like a different, you know, domino would fall every day. I mean, if you go through the microfilm, it's like every day a new headline, a new player implicated, a new fact revealed. But during that time, they scheduled a Board of Trustees meeting for May of 1961. And Bill Friday and Chancellors Aycock and Caldwell from Carolina and NC State started meeting, you know, regularly in the week or two leading up to that to decide what they were going to do. And Bill Friday had been given the power by the board to make these decisions unilaterally involving athletics, so he didn't need the board's approval. But the chancellors agreed with what was going on, and they drafted a, like, 15-page statement that included de-emphasizing basketball in a number of ways. Among those were they trimmed the schedule. They only allowed, I believe it was, 3 non-conference games and only a certain number before Christmas, and they also limited the out-of-state recruiting, because they felt like that was part of the problem. So all those things were announced, and the very last announcement on the document was that the Dixie Classic would be canceled.
Well, it's interesting. All the restrictions have now been compromised, other than that the Dixie Classic is still not with us.
It never came back.
And so in your discussions with the people who love the Dixie Classic and people who are involved in basketball, why doesn't it come back now after all these years and the elimination of maybe not of all the problems of big-time basketball, but the point-shaving scandal seems not to have come back.
Yeah, it's taken on a different form. You know, now we have agents paying players. And, you know, there's still dirty money, and there's still things that shouldn't be happening the way they are, but you're right, it's not quite the same. I think there's some innovations to the game that have made it harder for that kind of thing to happen. But in terms of the Dixie Classic coming back, there are those who still would like to see it. I actually found a Facebook page called Bring Back the Dixie Classic.
Oh, you did? Oh, wow.
and I know that even early after the cancellation, there were those who, you know, tried to introduce bills in the legislature, and it just never really went anywhere. The Big Four tournament, you know, was a direct result of the cancellation of the Classic, and it was played from, I believe, 71 to 81. And people enjoyed that tournament, but without somebody from the outside to beat up on, it just wasn't quite the same. And it didn't have the same kind of nostalgia or passion as the Classic.
Right. Well, I was thinking that you might say the coaches don't really want it anymore.
It's tricky when you think about how early in the season this is and the risk of the types of losses that you can incur, you know, before the new year. And so there are some who say coaches wouldn't want it. There are some who say it would never be the same. You know, with television coverage and, you know, the Maui Invitational is kind of today's holiday tournament. Well, that's a made-for-TV event. You know, the fans in the arena, first of all, there's more empty seats than there are fans. And second of all, they're not the fans from the schools that are playing. They're somebody on a Hawaiian vacation. And it's not a bad thing, but it just is indicative of how much the game has changed, more because of the advent of television coverage than anything else.
So you can play those games anywhere and leave the holiday games anywhere. And
just get a Hawaiian shirt for Roy Williams and, you know.
And maybe the argument is that the players enjoy going someplace different rather than playing in their hometown.
And Reynolds, of course, you know, they don't play in Reynolds anymore. They have a couple of games on their schedule this year. And and that was part of the charm. I mean, you know, it would just be hard to imagine it quite being what it was before. And maybe, well, I believe that it doesn't need to come back because I think people hold it so dear. And there's so many things that have changed in our culture and in our world with sports that it would be really hard to recapture that.
You wouldn't recognize it, I guess, because it would have to be smoke-free in the Dixie Classic.
That would be right. You'd be able to see the court.
But you couldn't do that. Well, look, this has been so much fun, and we've hardly scratched the surface of all the stories that you tell in your book, The Classic, how Everett Case and his tournament brought big-time basketball to the South. And Bethany Bratcher, we're looking forward to learning more about the book and having you come to Chapel Hill and telling us all about it.
That'd be great.
There are lots, I promise you, there are a lot of Dixie Classic fans who've stuck with it for these many years after its demise. Thanks for bringing back those great memories.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. It's been Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.